In a highly influential book published in 2002, the American economist William Easterly said that he cared about economic growth because it makes the lives of poor people better and frees the poor from hunger and disease, unquote. He then proceeded to show that growth improves infant mortality, that, for instance, in Africa, 500,000 deaths could have been averted if growth in the decade of the 1980s had been 1.5% higher. The above insights, in turn, contributed to an intense debate among professional economists and policymakers about the relative importance of various factors, policies, and institutions in creating the conditions for sustained growth. What is their relative importance? How do they interact with each other? How successful have countries been in identifying them and adopting them? A recent, and I think impressive, contribution to the ongoing debate is the 2008 study published by the Commission on Growth and Development, chaired by Nobel Economics Laureate Michael Spence. Two things, it seems to me, make this report a particularly valuable source of insight. First, the 21 commissioners who prepared it brought together a rich variety of perspectives, drawn from decades of experience in government, academia, and the business world, both in a developed and developing country context. Second, the report benefited from a wide-ranging process of consultation with leading experts on a broad range of issues, including the roles of fiscal policy, education, geography, trade, technology, institutions, and interactions with the environment, among many others. The Commission examined the experiences of 13 countries, which, beginning in 1960, grew at an average annual rate of at least 7% over a period of 25 years or more, and identified those factors, common or country-specific, which contributed to such remarkable economic performance. An economy which grows at an average annual rate of 7% doubles in size roughly every 10 years. The 13 economies examined are Botswana, Brazil, China, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Japan, the Republic of Korea, Malaysia, Malta, Oman, Singapore, Taiwan, and Thailand. During the periods of high growth, these economies exhibited some common features, including full exploitation of the opportunities afforded by the world economy through trade, foreign investment, and inward technology transfer, macroeconomic stability, and high rates of saving. On the whole, their reasonably competent governments were able to avoid some of the terrible mistakes which have been so costly to other countries, such as subsidizing energy consumption, using the civil service as employer of last resort, neglecting infrastructure, imposing price controls, and underestimating the importance of education as a key driver of the development process. Now, what is perhaps surprising in this report is that the Commission is unambiguous in the benefits it attaches to economic growth. Let me quote a small passage. "Growth is not an end in itself," they say, "but it makes it possible to achieve other important objectives of individuals and societies. It can spare people en masse from poverty and drudgery. Nothing else ever has. It also creates the resources to support healthcare, education, and the other Millennium Development Goals to which the world has committed itself. In short," they say, "we take the view that growth is a necessary, if not sufficient, condition for broader development, enlarging the scope for individuals to be productive and creative," unquote. They go on to say that, and I quote again, "in a very poor country, it is arithmetically impossible to reduce poverty without growth. There is no one to redistribute from. Conversely, if everyone is poor, growth will reduce poverty regardless of how it is distributed. But some kinds of growth reduce poverty more effectively than others. The expansion of smallholder farming, for instance, cuts poverty quickly, raising incomes of rural cultivators and reducing the price of the poor's food bill. Growth in labor-intensive manufacturing also raises the incomes of the poor. The expansion of capital-intensive mining industries, on the other hand, can result in jobless growth, making little impression on poverty." Unquote. Professor Spence was even more direct in his public pronouncements at the time that the report was released, saying that the growth report also kills off, once and for all, the misguided notion that you can lift people out of poverty in the absence of growth. Unquote. He also noted that India, quote, "to grow at a fast pace for another 13 to 15 years to catch up where China is today," and that it was expected that some 600 million people in China presently working in agriculture would need to move into more productive jobs in urban areas, and that therefore, as has happened in the past 20 years in China, and I quote, "growth will lift many more people out of poverty in the coming decades," unquote. Now, notwithstanding the unanimous consensus among the Growth Commission report's distinguished authors, their views are by no means universally shared, particularly among scientists and experts laboring on environmental issues. This is how the editors of the New Scientist article, which I quoted a few minutes ago, put it. "Growth, to most economists, is as essential as the air we breathe. It is, they claim, the only force capable of lifting the poor out of poverty, feeding the world's growing population, meeting the costs of rising public spending and stimulating technological development, not to mention funding increasingly expensive lifestyles. They see no limits to that growth, ever." Unquote. The essence of the arguments put forward by the environmentalists is that, and I quote one of them, Herman Daly, "our economy is now reaching the point where it is outstripping Earth's ability to sustain it. Resources are running out and waste sinks are becoming full. The remaining natural world can no longer support the existing economy, much less one that continues to expand." Unquote. A more cogent statement of the conventional economist's view on natural resource use goes more or less as follows, and I'm quoting here from a book on macroeconomics written by Professors Dornbusch and Fisher, Stanley Fisher. Quote, "production uses up natural resources, in particular energy. It is true, as is sometimes alleged, that exponential growth in the economy will eventually use up the fixed stock of resources," they ask. "Well, yes, it is true in the limited sense that current theories suggest that the universe will one day run down. However, this seems more of a concern for a course in astrophysics or perhaps theology than for a course in economics. Over any interesting horizon, the economy is protected from resource depletion disasters by two factors. First, technical progress permits us to produce more using fewer resources. For example, the energy efficiency of room lighting has increased by a factor of 4,500 times since Neolithic times. Second, as specific resources come into short supply, their prices rise, leading producers to shift towards substitutes." Unquote.